Hello, you are listening to KVNF, Mountain Grown Community Radio, and Local Motion, our weekly local affairs show. For KVNF News, I'm Eric Gould. In this installment of Local Motion, we'll hear several different perspectives that discuss the water situation in western Colorado. We've heard reports on the KVNF newscast about scientists and their dilemma about how to name what is happening. If a drought lasts for more than 18 years, it should be called something else. And yet, that is where we find ourselves, in the midst of one of the driest years on record. The Colorado River Basin is at a record low, and reservoirs along the Colorado River are no more than half full. The snowpack was at a record low level, and hot and dry weather conditions have arrived early in the West. Already, the drought has manifested in a very active fire season. Three wildfires have sprung up in Garfield County in the past 5 days. Montrose County has already seen two major blazes. Delta County had one. And the 416 fire outside of Durango continues to burn in nearly 35,000 acres of forest. Stage 2 fire restrictions are in place for most counties in western Colorado, and fireworks have been banned in most municipalities. And now, one town in Delta County has become the first to institute water restrictions. At the last meeting of the town of Hotchkiss Town Council, trustees voted to enact even-odd outdoor watering restrictions. Hotchkiss residents who live in houses ending in an even number will water on Mondays and Wednesdays. Those living in houses ending in odd numbers will water on Tuesday and Thursday. KVNF News spoke with Mike Owens, Public Works Coordinator for the town of Hotchkiss, and asked him about the restrictions. You're the first town in Delta County to have actual restrictions on water use. Why did Hotchkiss go ahead and make that decision?
Mainly, we just wanted to bring the awareness of the drought situation to the public. And, of course, the odd and even days, it still allows you to water three times a week, pretty much. And so it was basically just an awareness thing, get people thinking about it, to where hopefully down the road we don't have to restrict outside watering. So right now I think the town's in good shape as far as water. Not good shape, but it's adequate right now. As the summer goes on, it could get worse, and if Mother Nature doesn't give us some help along the way.
And I know it kind of comes at a bad time for Hotchkiss, too, because you're still working on your water system in terms of getting a new tower, right? The town is looking to get a new water tower?
We're building a water tank. Actually, the bid's been let. We haven't broke ground yet, but we're still running off the old tank, so that really is not an issue.
Is it a situation like the town of Paonia has, where they have two water tanks? Are you guys going to have two as well once this one is built, or is this going to replace the old one?
This is going to replace an old one that has reached the end of its lifetime, and we operate on three tanks. We've got a 1 million-gallon storage tank, we got a 350,000-gallon storage tank, and we've got a 450,000-gallon storage tank, which it's the 450 that is being rebuilt.
And then going back to the drought real quick, you've been there at Hotchkiss for a few years. Have you ever seen a situation like this where it is just such a drought all around the state?
We have had restrictions on in the past. It's been long enough now. I really don't know whether I could compare it to this or not, but this has been a very dry year for sure.
And the last question is just about what might come in the future. As you say, you could really get some help if it rained a lot more. And are there plans or procedures in place for Hotchkiss to go ahead and take if further restrictions are needed?
Not at this point as far as imposing more restrictions. And, we do have other water sources that are out there. It would just be costly to get tied into them, but at that point, we have to make that decision.
Mike Owens, thank you so much from the town of Hotchkiss. I really appreciate it. Thank you, sir.
You're welcome.
That was Mike Owens, Public Works Coordinator for the town of Hotchkiss. You are listening to Local Motion on KVNF, Mountain Grown Community Radio. and we are talking about water issues and the drought in western Colorado. Now we'll go to Paonia, where officials have not instituted restrictions, but are urging residents to conserve water. Residents are asked to make easy conservation efforts, like limiting use of irrigation water, doing full laundry loads rather than half, and not letting the water run needlessly. Paonia Town Manager Ken Knight said that the town wants to encourage conservation, not enforce it. Here he is talking with KVNF News. Let's just kind of start off with the article I read in the DCI where you talk about you're not asking for restrictions right now, but the town is recommending that people conserve. Just talk a little bit about that.
Well, yes, and of course, in many ways, we should always be looking at conserving water. Water is going to be a precious resource as we move forward. But as anybody who has lived here knows that this was a very dry winter, and the opportunity to conserve water now so that we don't end up with a larger problem later is, you know, I just think a good, prudent public policy and something that the town is recommending. Again, I just think it's a good, prudent policy at any time, and the last thing the town wants to do is implement conservation measures because they're very unpopular.
What would you say about your concern level? There's the 2.5 million gallon tank. The 1 million gallon tank right now is not online. Do you think that 2.5 million gallon tank, even in drought conditions, will be sufficient?
Yes, it really all depends on raw water. And one of the very positive things about the out-of-town water project is that we reduced the water leakage by anywhere from 8 to 13%. So that was water that was raw water that was leaking between the springs and the water plant. So by having the out-of-town water project and saving that amount of money, that helps a great deal to begin with. The 2-million-gallon tank can service all of the town's needs. The question is do we have enough raw water going into it? We have 4 springs that do not feed into the 2-million-gallon plant, and that we would have to put in a pumping system or something to get that up there and running. Whereas if we can get the 1-million-gallon plant back online, those 4 springs we can then treat with that plant and supplement our water that way. I am not terribly concerned at this point, although, again, to be prudent, we're looking for some conservation now, so if things do get worse, we don't have to implement serious and mandatory later.
And where are we now in terms of getting that 1 million gallon tank online?
We need to get it sandblasted. The liner that was installed during the project failed due to several reasons, and we need to get that old liner sandblasted off, which should take, once we have a contractor in place, about 10 days. And we already have approved from the state a new liner to go in there. It's a much more flexible liner, so it won't crack. The 1 million gallon tank is on, I guess you could say, it's further into the water table, so therefore it has a little bit of movement. And as you well know, with anything with concrete, if it has a little bit of movement and you have anything that's on that concrete that's brittle, you could end up with a crack. So we're going to be putting a sealant on it that's very similar to what the spray liners that you would put in the bed of a pickup truck or that you would use in your basement that has a little bit more flexibility, so therefore it won't crack. And that should be a 50-year sealer. So if we can get in there and get that sealed, and that's about a 4 or 5 day application. So once we get the sandblasters up and then once we get the sealer up, we should be able to get that tank online in about 3 weeks. It's just been a process of, one, getting the state to approve the liner, and two, we had some problems getting the contractors for sandblasting. We actually selected one, you may remember, at the last meeting. And when we called them to come out, they had suddenly gone out of business. So that's created a problem for us. So now we have to get another sandblasting contractor in here.
That was Paonia Town Manager Ken Knight speaking to KVNF News about water conservation efforts in Paonia. Now on Local Motion, we'll switch direction a little bit and look at the impact of the drought in western Colorado. Joe Lewandowski is the Public Information Officer for Parks and Wildlife in Ridgeway. He talked with KVNF News about the effects of the drought upon wildlife in the area.
First of all, for fish are obviously the most affected by low water and warm water. In this area, trout can be affected by water warming up. Once it hits about 70 degrees, it really stresses trout out. It's too warm for them, and so there can be problems. They'll be lethargic. So we ask people maybe not to fish, you know, at some creeks that are, you know, smaller creeks in the middle of the afternoon. The other thing that does is the water drops. Fish have less habitat to swim in. Aquatic insects have less places to grow, and that's what feeds the fish. And if it continues for year after year, the whole habitat shrinks for aquatic life. Along rivers, you know, cottonwoods, willows can die. Those help to provide shade and keep water cool. That takes a few years. It does happen, but again, in a prolonged drought, that's one of the worries. With terrestrial wildlife, they'll probably do okay. They've evolved to live with drought conditions. The big concern is if it, you know, if this continued, if we didn't get good monsoons, if we had some kind of prolonged drought for 2 or 3 years, it will impact, you know, shrubs and trees and grasses. And again, the amount of good habitat would decline. Terrestrial animals need a lot less water than we do. So, you know, if we get some good rains in the high country, you know, enough to kind of keep the ground moist and grow some new grasses, that's good enough for birds and, you know, big game, deer and elk and bears. Bears might be heading down to riparian corridors a little bit more this year, again, if we don't get moisture. So it does have an effect, but it's more of a long-term sort of question.
In terms of forests, forest fires can be good. They burn away old, you know, trees and then encourages regrowth. For animals, is it the same? Is there good things that can come from forest fires for animals?
Sure. You know, the first thing about a forest fire is animals really know how to get out of the way. So if we have a forest fire like the one we had down here in Durango, there might be some animals that got trapped. But in general, you know, they know to move out of the way. So the immediate effects are pretty minimal. Down the road, as this land gets some rain and snow on it, it'll sprout new shrubs and grasses and forbs, which wildlife eat. And, you know, in a couple years, as that stuff starts popping, that creates additional forage for big game and birds and you know, turkeys, things like that. So the long-term effects can be really helpful for terrestrial animals. It takes a couple of years. For fish, it's a mixed bag because if we do get a rain, we can get ash flows that will go down into the creeks. And if those are severe enough, they can suffocate fish. We haven't had that down here because we've had very little rain, but that's kind of one of the downsides for fisheries. But again, it takes a pretty significant ash flow in a small creek in bigger waters like the Gunnison River. That gets fairly well dispersed, but it is a concern, especially in areas where we have native cutthroat trout that we're trying to bring back in some of these smaller creeks.
And my last question is just about your experience as a Parks and Wildlife ranger. Have you seen a year like this before, and can you tell it already having a big impact on the animals out there?
We have seen years like this before. 2002 was quite dry, similar to this. As far as impacts, you know, we really haven't seen anything yet, you know, that we can kind of quantify in any way. You know, we had a late freeze in much of western Colorado, which really affected growth of acorns and different type of vegetation that bears and big game eat. And we had a tough bear year last year because there was so little food in natural areas. But so far this year, everything bloomed. We didn't have any freezes, and we're beyond the worry of any type of freeze. So at this point, things look pretty good. We are praying for the monsoons to kick in, and that will really help things in the high country and, throughout the state.
That was Joe Lewandowski from Colorado Parks and Wildlife. Here on Local Motion, we've talked about the historic drought on the western slope and how it's impacting towns and animals in the region. Next, we'll hear from Luke Runyon, who has been reporting on the Colorado River for the past year or so. He's been to the snowpack in the San Juans, and he's been to farms in New Mexico, reporting on the declining flow of the river and its impact on the 40 million people in 7 states that the Colorado River provides water for. Fear can be a powerful motivator, and there's one scenario along the Colorado River that is truly scary to those who are negotiating its future policies. It is called the Compact Call, and as Luke Runyon reports, imagining what it could look like is giving some Western water managers nightmares.
To talk about the Colorado River's present and future, you need to start in the past, specifically 1922. That's when leaders from the 7 Western states that rely on the river met at a Santa Fe resort to sign an agreement, the Colorado River Compact.
It's the cornerstone of how we allocate water on the Colorado River.
Andy Mueller is general manager of the Colorado River District, a water management agency in western Colorado.
On that cornerstone is built an incredible scaffolding of complex agreements, but it's all based in that 1922 compact.
It divided the river into the upper and lower basins. The upper includes states like Colorado and Wyoming. The lower is more desert-like, with Arizona, Nevada, and California. Even then, Mueller says there were concerns that California could end up owning every last drop of the river.
The reality is that the lower basin had the upper hand in those negotiations. They were developing faster.
So to get to a deal, the snowier states agreed that they were on the hook to deliver a certain amount of water to lower basin states. It was their job to make sure California, Arizona, and Nevada always got their share of the river's water. Now, this works fine when there's enough water to go around, and it all looked pretty good on paper, but...
There were hydrologists working for the Bureau of Reclamation who were like the canaries in the coal mine, even back then, saying, we don't have enough water.
Today, water levels in the system's biggest reservoirs, Lake Mead and Lake Powell, are dropping. Climate change is sapping the river's flow, and it's becoming easier and easier to imagine the lower basin making the dreaded compact call when those states say, give us our water.
It's never happened, and we don't want to see it happen because the chaos would cause economic uncertainty throughout the state.
Until now, this has just been an interesting thought experiment. How would this message get relayed? It could be a phone call.
It's California, Nevada, and Arizona on the line. They want their water.
Or maybe a text message.
Well, since we haven't ever had it, it's kind of hard to know.
Ann Castle is a senior fellow at the University of Colorado Boulder. She served in the Interior Department under President Obama.
I think it would probably take the form of a formal demand.
Okay, so it's more likely to be a boring letter, but it would set off a cascade of effects throughout the upper basin. States would have to rein in their own water use in order to meet their downstream obligations.
The state would likely start shutting down water rights from the most junior to as far as they had to go.
Those junior rights are often owned by cities, and a call would leave them scrambling to find more water supplies, so faucets in Denver, Albuquerque, and Salt Lake City didn't run dry.
We have to be ready. We don't want to make decisions about how we're going to handle a compact call should one occur when it's right there in front of us.
I was surprised to hear the Upper Basin express their concerns and fears when it's not something we've even really thought much about in the lower basin.
Jeff Keitlinger is in charge of the water agency serving the greater Los Angeles area. His agency, along with farmers in Southern California, would be the ones who would have to push for a compact call. And right now, he says they have way bigger fish to fry.
We're more focused on elevations in Lake Mead and what shortage conditions look like in the lower basin.
But he understands the upper basin's fears. And that's why Keitlinger says the focus now is on reining in water use throughout the basin to make sure a compact call never happens. I'm Luke Runyon.
This story is part of ongoing coverage of the Colorado River, produced in partnership with public media station KUNC in Northern Colorado, with financial support by the Walton Family Foundation. We just heard from Luke Runyon. Here on Local Motion, we've heard from two towns in Delta County about their efforts to conserve water. We've heard about the drought's impact on wildlife. And we've heard about a possible bleak future for the Colorado River. We'll finish Local Motion with a report from H2O Radio, which has this story about thinking outside the box when it comes to water conservation.
In May of 1862, President Abraham Lincoln signed the Homestead Act into law. It allowed any American, including freed slaves, to head west and claim up to 160 acres of federal land for free. The only hitch was the settlers had to build a home and farm the land within 5 years, a requirement that was probably a lot easier if the claim had water nearby. But even then, the farmer would have to get that water onto his fields to grow crops.
Basically, during the Homestead Act, the way they got water to the fields that they were farming is by cutting ditches that divert off streams and rivers.
That's Tyler Snyder, who ranches outside of Yampa, Colorado, in the northwest part of the state. His acres are a part of an old homestead where early farmers grew potatoes, had lettuce, and strawberries by flooding meadows with that diverted water. He's pretty impressed that those early settlers dug ditches in these rocky conditions using only picks and mules pulling plows, partly because he recently spent months digging miles of trench himself.
The biggest thing for us was sorting out the rocks because you don't want to have rocks sitting against your pipe. So we had to screen all the rocks, and that was the most time-consuming.
More than a century later, Snyder has installed pipelines on his property that move water differently than those historic ditches, a move that will save time, labor, and money, plus conserve the water itself. That whooshing sound you hear is water starting to flow through a pipe to a center pivot out on one of his fields. A center pivot is a way of irrigating that makes those big green circles you see from airplanes. Water comes up in the middle of a field, and motorized wheels move a long arm with sprinklers around in a circle. But this isn't any ordinary center pivot.
This is a hydromechanical center pivot.
Hydromechanical, meaning it's powered by moving water. No diesel or electricity to make it work, just gravity. The pressure that builds as the water is piped down the hillside is great enough to spin a turbine, which provides energy for the hydraulic motors. As the pivot pressurizes, water starts to spray out of nozzles strung along the long arm that stretches over a quarter of a mile out into his field, putting the droplets exactly where they need to go.
When you're flood irrigating, you're only using about 30 to 40% of the water in order to grow the same quality crop as you do with an efficiencies project that uses all the water that you put on. It doesn't run off.
He says when he was flood irrigating, the water would collect at the bottom of his fields, often leaving the top land burnt and dry. That moving water would also lead to erosion.
When you run water down a ditch, especially if you have steep hillsides as we do here, you can cause quite a bit of damage, and eventually you're going to have to send water down faster than it should go to get to different areas. And so then that causes gouges and nothing that can't be fixed, but for a rancher, it's not a priority to go fix it because once the wash is there, it's there.
So by switching to this center pivot, he's not only irrigating his fields more efficiently, he's been able to spread it across more land. He was flood irrigating 300 acres, But now?
Now we've spread it out across 500 acres for us. Yeah. That way we're making most efficient use of the reservoir water that we have.
That's an endorsement Sam Anderson likes to hear. He's an energy specialist for the Colorado Department of Agriculture, and through a program called Acre 3, he helped Snyder get the funding he needed to install his system.
Acre 3 stands for Advancing Colorado's Renewable Energy and Energy Efficiency, and it's an energy grants program that provides funding for farmers and agricultural producers to install different types of renewable energy systems or energy efficiency projects and take advantage of the energy resources that they already own as part of their land.
Resources they already own means, quite literally, falling water. Water drops nearly 380 feet from the top of Snyder's property to his fields, and that's a lot of hydropower if harnessed. Most of us hear hydropower and think Hoover Dam with its huge concrete wall, big intake towers, and torrents of water. But with microhydro, like what Snyder is doing, a farmer can capture the power of water with just a fraction of that.
We're not building any kinds of reservoirs or dams, and we're only using existing conduits or waterways and then taking advantage of the hydropower resource that's already there.
One of those existing hydropower resources is the numerous irrigation ditches and canals crisscrossing the state. But Snyder's ranch is in the mountains. Could a farmer down on the flat eastern plains do microhydro too? Jim Park of Kersey, Colorado did.
So we're just using this water for maybe 2 or 3 minutes as it goes down the hill and through the turbine, and then it lands in the same place at the bottom.
Park has an old homestead that's been in his family for generations, and we're standing next to a ditch that runs parallel to his field. It's pretty flat out here, but the 25-foot drop on his property is actually enough to generate electricity. The trick to this is concentrating water in a pipe.
It goes into a pipeline, and then that turbine down there has some movable gates on it that either open or close, and that determines how much water goes through the turbine. So if you close that down, it's going to stack the water up.
Stacking water in a pipe builds up pressure that can turn a turbine. But unlike Snyder, who used hydraulic power to run his center pivot, Park is actually generating electricity and sending it to the grid, the same way you would if you had solar panels on your house.
It's just kind of like Hoover Dam, only a lot smaller. Yeah, that's the secret of all hydro, is the higher you can stack that water up, the more power you can generate.
Last year, he generated about 10,000 kilowatts a month, nearly enough electricity to offset the cost of running his center pivot. For reference, a typical home will use around 12,000 kilowatts per year.
And the nice thing about hydro, it works day or night, works whether the wind blows or the wind doesn't blow.
And while it's true that water moves whether the sun is shining or the wind is blowing, there's an interesting and perhaps ironic twist about Jim Park's hydroelectric system.
The only reason I really have done this is because of oil and gas. The deal up there across the highway is on our land, and there's like 4 horizontal wells, and I really wouldn't have done it had that not been the case.
Yes, fossil fuels paid for renewable energy. For H2O Radio, I'm Franny Halperin. H2O Radio's series, The Dirt, is underwritten by the One World, One Water Center, a collaboration between Metropolitan State University of Denver and Denver Botanic Gardens to raise awareness of water and the environment through water stewardship.
And that brings our local motion about water issues and the drought to a close. One thing is for certain here in this record warm and dry year. This won't be the last time we will be discussing the drought and its impact on the KVNF listening area. For KVNF News, I'm Eric Gould. Thanks so much for listening.